afternoon and good evening and good morning to everybody. It's Mitchell Warren from AVAC and delighted to welcome you all to this call. We are just waiting for a few more dial-outs and then we will get started, and I'll walk through the schedule for the next hour or so and then give some instructions because we really, really do want this to be a conversation. So just bear with us another minute and we will get started. Mm-hmm. And Meg, is Bob there with you as well now?
Yes, I am. Hi, Mitch.
Oh, hello, Bob. Fantastic. Welcome. And for those of you on the phone, hopefully you will also be on the web link where the slides are available, and they'll be posted later along with the recording of the call. If you're having any trouble, though, please be sure you can always email avac@avac.org, and we will make sure that you can see them. But hopefully, if you're logged into the ReadyTalk web interface, you'll be able to see the slides in addition to hearing the call. So I think we will go ahead and get started, given the interest of time. We have a lot of people on the line, and I know it's late for some and early for others, so want to be sure we use our time best together. I am really delighted to welcome you all to this call. At what I think is one of the most exciting times in the AIDS response, frankly, for many, many years. As you all will know, and the reason you're on the call, of course, last Wednesday, the World Health Organization provided an early release of guidelines related to both antiretroviral therapy as well as to PrEP. And we are very pleased to have Meg Dougherty from WHO, who's really led the guideline process, not just in this year, 2015, and the update, but back to 2013 when the first consolidated guidelines were developed and launched. The work that has taken place over the last couple of years, both the science that has driven the guidelines and the guidelines themselves, elements of which are known to many at different points, but really delighted to welcome Meg as well as Bob Grant, who all of you will know has been a real pioneer in the oral PrEP work, amongst other things, and has really been critical to the work of both generating the evidence for oral PrEP, but also in assisting with the guidelines development. So I'm delighted that both Meg and Bob were able to join from Geneva. In just a moment, I'm going to turn it over to Meg to start with an overview presentation along with Bob about the guidelines. We will then open it up for the balance of the call for questions and answers and discussion. You are more than welcome to be sending questions to us via the chat feature if you're on the ReadyTalk interface, or you can send an email to avac@avac.org, and we'll put those in the queue. And you can also, once the presentation is done, we'll have a chance to take live questions, and I'll explain then about unmuting and then muting again as we are recording the line for our ability to post it later on. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Meg, who's in the HIV department at WHO, and as I said, has really led the development of the consolidated guidelines. And Meg, your slides are up and happy to advance them for you as you go.
Okay, thank you very much. And just to thank AVAC for having us and presenting on the early release guidelines, which are very new to us as well as to everyone around the world. And so we're really pleased to be able to share more information. Next slide, please. So I'm going to start with our thank yous because certainly getting this work done has been a year and a half long process, and there are many different people who have contributed, and probably on this acknowledgement slide, it's not everyone there because there's been 42 different people who have contributed to the clinical guideline group, as well as some odd 30 people who have been working on the PrEP technical working group, and all of the different contributors for our systematic reviews and community consultations and all of our funders. We do need to acknowledge that they've been there with us throughout this process, as well as a huge team here at WHO who's been key to getting this work done. Next slide. Many of you will be familiar with this organogram around our guidelines, and this began back in 2013 where we consolidated both the clinical the operational and service delivery, as well as the programmatic aspects of the guidelines across all populations. So this slide is recycled, but what's in yellow is what's new. So in the clinical aspects of this guideline for 2015, we'll still cover when to start and what to use and how to monitor, but we're also adding in new information around co-infections related to HIV and NCDs and HIV and mental health, as well as PEP and PrEP, which you're going to be hearing about later. We also have expanded our operational and service delivery aspects of the guideline, including differentiated care, which many of you may be hearing about lately in terms of how to handle both stable patients as well as persons who are late to presentation and how best to organize the care system to be able to handle the many more people who will become eligible and coming into treatment and care in the future, as well as quality of care and in also in updating to area to interventions around linkage, retention, and adherence. We also will have chapters on how to think about prioritization and sequencing. We know that we are going to be challenging countries with these recommendations. A new recommendation to treat all is going to be difficult for some countries, easier for others, and we want to be able to provide some of the skills and toolkits and examples to countries as they think about how and when to introduce all of these new recommendations that we'll be making. Next slide, please. I just also want to give you a bit of a background of how much work goes into the development of guidelines. And it includes, because we start at the 2013 recommendations, so we're not starting from zero. But then we have to relook at those questions, how many of them need to be updated, and we have commissioned a number of systematic reviews, close to 50 systematic reviews. We have included modeling data, surveys of use of ARVs and the pricing of ARVs in diagnostics. We look at feasibility and cost. And lastly, the circling gray on values and preferences, we have really increased our work in this area over the last year and a half, where we are now bringing in qualitative data on what persons value. We have done an enormous work with community on community consultations and healthcare workers' perceptions, as well as program managers, and a bit of looking at what constitutes quality of care. Next.
Meg, as we go to the next slide, there's some people who are just commenting that if you can do, it's a little hard to hear. If you could get a little closer to the phone, that would be great.
Sure. I hope this is a little better. This slide really just says it all. This is our five policy scenarios on ART eligibility, and we in 2013 put out guidelines raising the threshold to 500 and having certain indications at any CD4 counts. And now with the new early release recommendations, we are saying treat all populations, all age groups, raising the number of persons eligible for treatment to nearly 37 million. Next slide, please. And this is the take-home message slide and table of our new recommendations around when to start or when to initiate therapy. And essentially across all target populations, adults, pregnant women, breastfeeding women, adolescents, and children, we have specific recommendations saying or indicating we should be treating all at any CD4 count. However, we are still prioritizing those who are the sickest. The guideline development group felt that there were still nearly a quarter to one-third of patients who present with a CD4 less than 200 or less than 350, and that those persons really needed to make sure that they were on therapy and that they initiate it as soon as possible. So that prioritization remains within our recommendations. You also note related to pregnant and breastfeeding women, we've revised this recommendation, and now clearly option B plus is the choice, and option B is being scaled down or no longer relevant in the era of treating all. And we'll go through the evidence around the strength of the recommendation and the quality of the evidence in the next in the following slides. Next slide. So in looking at the evidence of when to start for adults, at the time that we had our guideline review meeting, which was in the beginning of June, we had just a press release from START, but we did have data from the Temprano START study and 17 observational cohorts. And with that, we looked at outcomes including mortality, severe HIV disease, progression, AIDS, non-AIDS events, malignancies, tuberculosis, transmission, severe adverse effects and lab abnormalities, and a composite outcome of severe HIV disease or malignancy or mortality as a combined outcome. Next slide. And this is a summary slide that shows the main outcomes from the systematic review, which primarily looks at the data from both the observational studies and from the Temprano trial. And I will give you a sense of why just the Temprano trial in this systematic review. We will be updating and including the START trial, but there were some differences in the comparator group where we were really looking at a question of, because we had already raised the thresholds to initiate at less than 500, our question was, does starting antiretroviral therapy over 500 compared to less than 500, is there a clinical outcome or benefit for a person? Is there a transmission benefit? And what we see is that with the systematic review, that there is evidence of a benefit. So on the first image or the first forest plot, which looks at severe HIV morbidity, you see that, yes, there it's starting earlier at greater than 500 favors reduction in HIV morbidity. It also favors in the next group or next forest plot, it favors reduction of disease progression. And it also favors reduction in HIV transmission. So overall, there's less severe morbidity, less HIV disease progression, and less transmission without an increase in either grade 3 or 4 lab adverse events or abnormalities, both renal abnormalities and hepatic abnormalities. So overall, the evidence shows overwhelmingly that there's both personal clinical benefits as well as population benefits to starting above 500. Next slide. And I thought I would just give you an overview of the three trials that really have also shown similar trends. The HPTN052 publication that came from Greenspring et al. And if you look at that first image on HPTN052, the one challenge we have with that trial is that they initiated all persons in the control arm at less than 250. So in many ways, although there's a similar directionality that earlier ART is more beneficial, it's not exactly the same question that we are asking in our 2015 ARV guideline reviews. If you look at the Temprano trial outcomes in the middle of the slide, you can see there we had a subgroup of where we could look at CD4 initiation greater than 500 and compared to that less than 500. And with that and with IPT, we saw that earlier ART and earlier ART with INH prophylaxis really improved the outcome over time. As well as with the START, now we know that they also showed a significant reduction in morbidity and death and the composite outcome when starting above 500. However, their comparator group was less than 350 CD4 counts. We will be updating our systematic review to include this START trial, but it's really a different question. It's more a question of, is over 500 better compared to any initiation time frame? And I think we can say clearly the evidence is showing us in directionality that yes, it is. Next slide, please. And again, this just shows the primary outcomes for each of these three studies, again, showing a reduction in the composite outcomes of death, mortality, and morbidity and severe disease for all of these trials. Next slide. For the evidence for adolescents and for children, we did not have direct evidence in support of earlier initiation. Both the Temprano and the START trials did not have adolescents, and there is not a comparable trial for children. So what we did do is we looked to South Africa, and then we worked with them on a modeling based upon data. And there's indirect evidence suggesting that mortality, a reduction in mortality and improvement in growth for children aged 5 to 10 years with a CD4 count greater than 500, as well as a growing body of evidence demonstrating a positive impact on growth, nerve development, immunological recovery, and preventing pubertal delay. These gains appear to be more limited for those adolescents who are vertically, who have received their HIV from their mothers or through vertical transmission. However, there still appears to be a benefit of immediate ART, thus leading to our recommendation for adolescents to treat all. However, you will notice that it is a conditional recommendation based upon the indirectness of the evidence. Next slide, please. This slide just shows that we had a very large community consultation, which was incredibly helpful as we went to make the decisions for the guideline development group. Where we looked at acceptability of earlier initiation of ART, and across all of these groups, there were 24 workshops in 8 countries, 8 subpopulations, 206 people living with HIV, and 74 service providers. Early initiation was deemed acceptable, and there were specific considerations that were highlighted about, one, collaborative decision-making, that ultimately the decision to initiate needs to be client-driven. 2, there needs to be comprehensive and accurate information given to ensure readiness. And there was a concern that initiation is relatively easy to do, however, maintenance and adherence is more challenging, and that we need to put extra effort there, and that we continue to need to work on stigma and discrimination. Next slide. This slide really also shows just briefly the modeling. The HIV Modeling Consortium looked at initiation and over time what was related to what one could see in terms of associations with death. And over time, one could see that HIV deaths are can be identified within this pre-ART in the undiagnosed persons or the diagnosed and never linked, so in the yellow, brown, and green. And that we need to, by eliminating this pre-ART period, we may also be able to reduce the future deaths from persons who are not yet enrolled and on ART. And over time, only 10 to 30% of deaths will be among those who are stably on ART. So our work to diminish those risks in the pre-ART period or the person who is coming in and out of care or not yet linked to care is where we need to be focusing our efforts. Next slide. So now I'm going to hand over to Bob, and then Bob will hand over back to me at the end for some concluding remarks. But to Bob, thanks.
Hello, everyone. The new recommendations for antiretrovirals include a broader recommendation for PrEP. Essentially, the new recommendation says that PrEP should be offered to people at substantial risk as part of a comprehensive prevention package. The recommendation is very carefully worded to reflect offering PrEP. Certainly we don't think anyone has to take PrEP or everyone that anyone should be coerced, but we think that PrEP should be available to people at substantial risk. And the basis for this is really that there's an ongoing forward transmission of HIV, 2.1 million people infected in 2013. The burden is much higher in MSM and transgender women, and there's high rates of HIV incidence among MSM in all regions. There's also regions of the world where female sex workers have a very high prevalence and we believe a high incidence. And then there's adolescent girls and young women having a very high incidence in southern African countries. Next slide. This new PrEP recommendation was based on a comprehensive review of evidence regarding PrEP. We found 10 studies that allowed some assessment of PrEP efficacy and safety, and the results are here on this table. And what we see is that there's consistent evidence of PrEP effectiveness in all populations, including men and women, younger people and older people, people using tenofovir disoproxil fumarate alone versus people using the co-formulated amitriptyline TDF, and in people who are exposed via rectal intercourse versus people who are exposed via vaginal and penile intercourse. So the only significant interaction we identified was with regard to adherence. PrEP works when it's taken, and it doesn't work when it's not taken. And this was the only statistically significant interaction that modified the effectiveness of PrEP in our meta-analysis of 10 different studies. Next slide. And this is just displays the one interaction we saw, showing that the protective effect or the log risk ratio varied very directly with the amount or the proportion of people in the active arm of each trial that had detectable drug, with the CDC safety study really showing the highest point estimate of efficacy and nearly universal detection of drug. Now, that was a very small study, having only 7 events, but it was evidence of efficacy in that case. And so moderate use of PrEP is associated with moderate effectiveness on an intention to treat basis, and if adherence is very low in the active arm, then did not see a benefit. Next slide. So this is the latest in a series of evolving recommendations. In 2012, the WHO provided guidance to for use of PrEP in MSM and serodiscordant couples, suggesting that it be provided in the context of demonstration projects to encourage countries to conduct research that optimized the delivery of PrEP. In 2014, there was a consolidated key population guidelines that strongly recommended PrEP for men who have sex with men as an additional prevention choice with high-quality evidence. And so this new recommendation is that oral PrEP containing TDF should be offered as an additional prevention choice for people with substantial risk of HIV infection as part of a combination of prevention approach. And in 2016, we will be delivering comprehensive implementation guidance and a package of implementation tools that people can adapt and use to develop PrEP programs in different epidemiological and social settings. Next slide.
And Bob, if you could, as you go to the next slide, if you could also a little louder or closer to the microphone.
Okay. All right. So this new recommendation, it differs in that we are moving away from conceiving of PrEP targeting in terms of key populations. And so the new recommendation refers to substantial risk, and which we understand can be a vague concept. But we want to emphasize that this is something that needs to be defined in terms of local epidemiology, that who is at substantial risk is going to vary from place to place. MSM are at, a portion of MSM are at substantial risk in all areas, but female sex workers may have low risk in some settings and extremely high risk in others. So this is how we're formulating substantial risk, is that that our estimates in collaboration with UNAIDS is suggesting that if PrEP is used in populations that would otherwise have an incidence of HIV of greater than 3 per 100 person years, PrEP would be expected to be cost-saving in that setting. And but we understand that no matter how we define a risk group that may be a candidate for PrEP, there's going to be enormous heterogeneity in risk, and so we need to have and develop simple screening questions to help identify those most at risk within groups that are have a substantial burden of infection. And that's the second step. And then finally, PrEP adherence is always highest if it's offered to people who want it. And that's the key variable for adherence. So we want to emphasize that PrEP should be offered and it should be preferentially delivered to people who actually want it. We don't see a point in trying to coerce or manipulate people into taking PrEP if they haven't arrived at that decision of part of their life plan. So now I go back to Meg.
Hi, thank you. Next slide. I think what we just want to finally sum up is what are some of the overall thinking. We do think that there's now going to be approximately 37 million people eligible for treatment, as well as a number that we have yet to quantify eligible for PrEP, but there will be many. So there is a gap, but we don't believe from the experiences that we've seen from countries that have started treat all, such as Brazil or Uganda, who are treating all children. We don't believe that this is going to change overnight, that the systems are going to be completely overwhelmed at one go. But with both of those countries, they have to prepare, they have to make sure there is enough drug available, and that it is something that will also only increase to this number of 22 million to fill the gap if there is a change in the testing approaches. So I do want to also give a shout out for the HIV testing guidelines that came out in July of 2015, which also provides more guidance for countries on different approaches to target testing and improved testing, and we do know that that is the one part of the 90 that needs extra work to be able to get all of those 37 million people who should be on therapy identified, knowing their status, and close to initiating treatment. Next slide. What has come up as well is how much will this cost, and we just simply have been looking at what the UNAIDS has been reporting in their fast-track report, is that the investments are currently in 2014-2015 approximately $20 billion per year for the entire HIV health sector response. About 50% of that is related to just testing and treatment, so approximately $10 to $11 billion per year in 2014-2015. This will go up to a peak of approximately $32 billion in 2020, and then there will be some gain on those investments by year 2030. And again, half of this is related to just testing and treatment. So we do know that we will need to have greater investments. There may be many places to achieve efficiencies, but it will also depend upon identifying all of those persons who currently are not aware of their status. Next slide. So in summary, what's new in the early release? We have a recommendation to treat all at any CD4 count for all people with HIV across all ages. The sickest remain a priority. We have a new age band that we have pulled out for adolescents that we have maintained throughout our guidelines of age 10 to 19. We are not putting forward option B. Option B plus is the new standard. And PrEP is recommended as an additional prevention choice for all people at substantial risk of HIV infection, which you heard from Bob. Next slide. And I just wanted to finally share with you our timeline. We'll be having the full launch of the guidelines, which includes the service delivery and operational recommendations, as well as what to use in first line, second line, and third line. And we'll be sharing that at the ECASA meeting and for World AIDS Day this year, 2015. So I'll just go to the last slide. These are just some of the supporting commentary that we have gotten since last week when we put this new early release guideline onto the web. And so far, so good. We have lots of global support. And now it really becomes the harder part of supporting countries and supporting the ability for countries to move either financially and or with their human resources and systems to make this a reality. So with that, we'll hand over to Mitch. Unless Bob, do you have a final comment? No. We'll hand over to you, Mitch, and we're happy to take questions.
Great. Meg and Bob, thank you both so very, very much for a terrific overview that was wonderfully clear both in slide and in your commentary. A lot of questions, some have actually come before the call even started. We've had more come in as we've gone. So a number of them actually maybe got addressed in one of your latter slides, Meg, but I think that it's come up a bunch since Wednesday, and I just think to have you go over it again, and that is the estimated costing of implementing these guidelines, because I know it came up in a lot of the early press reports that this was groundbreaking, but what was the price tag? And I wonder, and there were a number of questions related to what the conversation is with donors. In your last slide, you'd show both Ambassador Birx and Ambassador Dybul both expressing from PEPFAR and Global Fund's perspective, but what's been kind of the conversation with respect to mobilizing resources both globally and then at the country level, and wonder if you have any sense of that in the early days.
Hi, Mitchell. Thank you. That's a hard question, clearly, but always good to start with a hard question. And I think if we go to slide 20, where this is coming from this slide shows the targets and the costs. And this comes from the fast-track documents out of UNAIDS. So this is based on their modeling, which has quite a bit of different assumptions and costing around various inputs. And I didn't attach another slide where in that document you can see how they break down those costs. See if I can pull one up or talking so I can walk you through it. But on all of those estimates, it has been really that the estimate is approximately 50% would go to treatment and to testing. And we do believe that there are going to be efficiencies, and there is a recent modeling and costing effort that's going on by CHAI that has shown that they could even get this cost much lower, and Bob and I were looking at some of those CHAI estimates just last week at another meeting. I think there is a sense that we need to get more realistic in what are the realistic costs, but that from my impressions, this is not going to be cost neutral. There will need to be increase in donor support and country level support. So the conversation is just happening now, and I think the best outcome has been that both Mark Dybul and Ambassador Birx are very supportive of this and feeling as if this is the right way to go. Their approach may be to have countries become more focused, identify which parts and which areas in the country can do this best, focus on those kind of sections of the health sector and to be able to implement this. And certainly for the countries that have resources, a greater expectation that countries will be contributing to their domestic response and their local response. So we do know that currently there are some countries that are already costing this out to see how they can do this themselves, such as with South Africa, but there are others that are going to obviously need support and help from us, and it may be, from the global community, it may be taking them a little bit longer to reach these goals, such as the Malawis of the world, and others, the Tanzanians and Zambias, were feeling very stretched for identifying drugs. Bob has something to add to that. So slightly vague, I think the costing from UNAIDS may be very large because it's doing a multi-sectoral approach. We may have to focus on the sort of the health sector in the short term and find efficiencies. But here's Bob.
I think it's early days. These are new recommendations. I think we need to try to highlight is emerging evidence that these investments can pay off in dramatic decreases in numbers of new infections. And, we're hearing rumors from a number of different regions that have been successful in rolling out PrEP and treatment and testing. And, I think as public health leaders and financial leaders see a real impact, they'll be much more inclined to see these as good investments. I would like to highlight that this money exists. There is this money in the world. It's a matter of using the political process to allocate it toward good investments. And again, I think we need impact, but we also need to broaden our constituencies. And one of the reasons that we're very enthusiastic about combining or publishing the treatment recommendation with the PrEP recommendation is that we see that this is going to create a much broader constituency of people who care about funding for HIV. It's going to go from primarily an issue for people living with HIV to an issue for people living with HIV and people who are potentially exposed to HIV, people who are part of families where HIV exists. I think that with a broader constituency, it's going to be easier to mobilize the political process around raising money.
Yeah, Bob, and thank you both, Bob and Meg. A really important conversation that obviously just begins with the guidelines. And I know increasingly many of us are talking about the importance when asked, how much is it going to cost? And it's more a question of how much does it cost if we don't act with these guidelines in mind. There are a couple questions came in. Meg, your final point there was about, I think very importantly, domestic resources at the country level. And the related question came in from a couple of different people, and that is, although it's obviously very early days to know about the 2015 guidelines being adopted or adapted at the country level, do you have a sense of numbers of countries that acted on the 2013 guidelines? And what was the kind of scale of adoption of those guidelines? And do you imagine, and are you talking to countries about, if you haven't gone to 2013, fast forward and go straight to 2015, or what is that kind of conversation like with countries?
Thank you. We have not yet had the conversation with countries in particular about adopting these new guidelines. We have put out on our website a programmatic update where we did look at a series of countries that had already gone to test and treat or treating all. And there were five countries there, and I outlined and identified how they did this. In terms of going back and taking a look at the 2013 guidelines, we have shared at IAS a presentation on the number of countries that have moved to and beyond the 2013 guidelines, and I'm just trying to find them right now. But in terms of uptake, it's something over 50% of low and middle income countries around the world have adopted the 500 threshold, and approximately 6% had adopted treat all, and I'd be happy to share those and send those slides on to you. And when we look further down into our focus countries, we're already at over 78, almost at 8% of countries, those 58 focus countries, who went to 500. The countries that had not gone to 500 were those, I believe, who were really quite worried about where their drug would come from and how they would pay for that. And not to pick out countries, but there were certain countries in sub-Saharan Africa who are either very dependent on Global Fund or very dependent on their own resources, and both those in that category who have very large burden in, of numbers of persons to put on therapy, it was really a struggle of how much to put into treatment. Could they sustain this over time, and did they have the internal resources for that? So I think as there's clear evidence in terms of both the clinical and transmission benefits, I think we will be willing and sitting with those countries to see how best to organize their not only their policies, but their implementation of these policies. And it may just take a little longer for some of those countries. WHO, we don't consider ourselves the guideline police. We really want to help capacitate countries to be able to do this and to feel comfortable about doing this, and also doing this when they themselves have enough human resources, they have a sense that there will be a sustainable response, and our goal is to really be there with them and their ministries of health as they make those decisions. So my sense is in the next year we'll be doing the same sort of rollout process that we did with the 2013 guidelines, going to the regions, working with teams from Ministry of Health, WHO partners, to be able to identify how best to implement, which needs to come first, how to plan, is certainly now planning for the supply chain and the drug to be available, which is certainly we would hate to see countries adopt immediately and then have large stockouts. So there needs to be planning, and we've been working with both the supply chain folks and the generics. They've been quite aware of where we're headed to. So I think there's a sense that there will be enough drug available as countries start to move. So I would imagine there's going to be a good handful, 50% of our low- and middle-income countries willing to move, because, but probably within the year.
Great. Thank you, Megan. I know – oh, sorry, go ahead. Oh, that's terrific, Megan. I think, and we will be sure to post your presentation from Vancouver related to the 2013 guidelines, because I think it does set a very good metric for us to be looking at what happens with the adoption of these guidelines. Bob, a number of questions came in that I might direct to you now about the PrEP recommendation. A series of them relate to pills, and several of them relate to people. So perhaps I'll just ask them together and leave it to you to answer both. One is, in the table you showed both tenofovir and TDF and TDF-STC, and people have asked, what is the specific recommendation about the combination drug versus tenofovir alone? And then related to the people question, a number of comments have come in asking about this measurement of substantial risk and this 3% number. And I know you described it in the presentation, but if you could kind of walk people through again what we mean and what people are thinking about substantial risk and how we might be able to best both understand it but also articulate it. So if you could take both of those questions, that would be great.
Well, thank you. One of the surprising findings from the meta-analysis was that the estimate of the effectiveness of TDF alone was very similar to the effectiveness of FTC-TDF. There was only one study that compared them head-to-head, and in fact they found that was Partners PrEP, and they found no statistically significant difference between the two regimens. So the recommendation is that PrEP containing TDF should be offered. And we don't, in the guidelines, so far, we don't really indicate a preference of one over the other. But in the implementation guidance, we will be highlighting that, there really is only one study that examined TDF PrEP alone in men who have sex with men. It was a very small study called the U.S. Safety Study. And in that study, there were 7 seroconversions in people during the deferred arm or the placebo arm, and versus 0 during periods when they were actively receiving TDF PrEP. So 0 versus 7 is certainly a trend toward a very strong signal of efficacy, but it's not a large enough study to really prove how well TDF PrEP alone can work for men who have sex with men. But I think it opens the door to allowing some flexibility for countries who may have registered different drugs over the years. And so, I think that if they have Truvada on the formulary, that certainly is the co-formulation that's been most widely evaluated. If it has a reasonable cost, then that may be a good choice. But other countries where only TDF is available or TDF is available with 3TC, either TDF alone or TDF and 3TC could be considered. These differences are expected to become even more important after 2017, when TDF goes off patent globally. And, of course, 3TC is already off patent, whereas FTC alone and FTC-TDF will continue to have patent protections through 2022. So we do think that it's important that countries realize that TDF alone is effective, at least for heterosexual populations and people who inject drugs, and that the cost benefit of TDF alone may far exceed that of Truvada in some settings, and that will be changing over time as patent protections change. Now, substantial risk is a concept that We intend to fully operationalize in our implementation guidance, but in the recommendation already, there's quite a large number of paragraphs about what we mean by that. It really derives from a cost-saving consideration, and we do think that in many situations, if PrEP is given to a group that would otherwise have an incidence of HIV of more than 3 per 100 person years, or 3% per year, if PrEP is given to groups like that, it actually ends up saving money in the sense that, you know, some money is spent to provide PrEP, but much more money is spent is saved by preventing HIV infections. And so that is certainly a sweet spot for providing PrEP. And we do also know that we can readily identify groups that have incidence between 3 and 10% per year in a variety of different settings. MSM, particularly young MSM in many places of the world, when they're followed over time, they'll have an incidence that ranges between 4 and 9% per year. Young adolescent girls and young women in South Africa have an incidence that's that high. Female sex workers in places in Africa also have a high incidence, and high meaning well over 3% per year. And so, you know, I think that all we can say at this point is you know, we need to know our epidemic, and the epidemic is different in different settings. And I think that we're on the verge of becoming much more sophisticated about identifying where and under what circumstances and when HIV is being transmitted. You know, the need to provide PrEP when and where it's needed is really going to create an opportunity for us to become much more savvy about, you know, when and where HIV is being transmitted. And I think we're going to move away from sort of broad categorization of key populations or risk groups and toward situations that are risky, and we can anticipate as people move in and out of situations and seasons of risk that PrEP will have its greatest impact. But in general, if you want a simple statement, we're thinking that in many settings, an incidence of greater than 3% per year is a situation where PrEP is clearly justified to be offered. By the way, the ISUSA decided that that number should be 2% per year in the United States, and that represents sort of a willingness to reach down into cost effectiveness rather than sticking with cost-saving situations.
Great. Super helpful, Bob. I think this last issue, there were a couple of questions that came in about how to measure impact, really, at different levels. And so it's true both for PrEP and also, I think, for Meg to speak to the treatment guidance in terms of diagnostics and how we know we're doing the various things. So I guess to both of you, questions about measuring incidence, which has been, I think, for most of us, most often known in the actual clinical trials. But, you know, if you can comment at all about, you know, incidence assays and what might or should happen to help us better understand how to truly monitor incidence. And then on a different diagnostic question for you, Meg, a question about the use of CD4 count versus viral load, and if you could just speak a bit to the thinking in the guidelines to the use now that the CD4 measures being dropped from the actual recommendation.
So progress is being made on developing assays for HIV incidence. The old generation of serological assays like DED probably have limited utility due to just how variable the assay is, and unfortunately those assays are also affected by antiretroviral exposure. So as we roll out PrEP and PEP and treatment, the serologic assays for early infection or incident infection are going to become even less reliable than they have been. But saving the day, I think, is emerging information that the sequence, the viral sequence that we derive routinely as part of our resistance testing is providing really rich and powerful information about the duration of infection. So, I think progress is being made on incidence assays. I also think that, you know, we're going to need excellent surveillance, and this is essentially how New York and San Francisco and other places in the United States are tracking transmission and trying to identify and dissect out what's helping and what still needs to be done in terms of ending HIV transmission. It's really through active surveillance. And so I think that developing sort of cost-effective and efficient ways to provide active surveillance for new cases, incident cases, and understanding the circumstances in which transmission still occurs is going to be very important. And by the way, this is a lesson learned from the huge success that many countries have had in preventing maternal-to-child transmission. And one of the cornerstones of the 20 years of development of interventions in preventing perinatal transmission is that it gets to a point where you need to be curious and understand every single case of transmission, because you can learn everything you need to know about why one person becomes infected, even when there is some therapy available and there's some PrEP available. And so I think that what I call each one matters case review of HIV transmission cases is something that has been a proven concept in perinatal transmission prevention, and it's something that we need to adopt for sexual transmission prevention as well. Here's Meg.
Hi, thank you for the question regarding what are we going to be saying about CD4 versus viral load. In 2013, we made the recommendation that viral load is the preferred measure for monitoring the response. And we will be continuing to say that viral load is the preferred diagnostic for monitoring the response. With that, we had also said that we could start to scale down the use of CD4 for monitoring, and we did a systematic review found in the further guidelines in December. Well, we'll show when it's safe to scale down the use of CD4 for stable patients or who have been shown that they have a consistently suppressed viral load. And we provide some metrics around that for you, for countries to be able to know when and how to use CD4. In the discussion about when to start and also how to use, when is CD4 useful, there was, from the guideline development group, there's still a considerable feeling that CD4 has its utility in identifying when a person is very ill and what interventions need to be done rapidly to save that person's life. For example, when one would need to know when a certain cryptococcal antigen has to happen and when treatment and a lumbar puncture needs to be done. So with that, we have also identified sort of a definition around persons who present late and what that might look like, and when a CD4 would be very useful in terms of clinical management. So we don't recognize, we don't think that CD4 needs to be done for eligibility. However, a CD4 done somewhere along the time in early diagnosis will be a useful clinical test, much like we might want to get a serum creatinine or a hemoglobin or others, because this can be very helpful. And in the meantime, we know that many countries have CD4 but don't have viral load. And there are pieces of information that one can garner from a CD4. So we have a whole section on how what we're saying about CD4, but clearly we don't want to see it as a roadblock or a hindrance to initiating therapy, but we also see it as a very strong, powerful clinical tool for saving people when they present very late in care. And some of that you can't identify just simply through staging or through a clinical exam. Some of that can be brought forward only with the CD4 test.
Great, Meg, thank you for that, and Bob, too. A question, a number of people have commented on the enormity of scaling up, and particularly around human resources, and a couple people asked questions about the role of different delivery models, and that's true, I guess, for both treatment and for PrEP around kind of community-oriented delivery. And I wonder, maybe that's more for the implementation guidance that's forthcoming, but I wondered if either of you wanted to comment a bit about that as we think about the scaling up.
Yes, I think both universal treatment and PrEP, as we've conceived it, are amenable to algorithmic development, which would allow for cost shifting to, away from physicians, away from even nurses, to other clinic staff. I also think that community-based organizations are developing a greater role in providing both treatment and PrEP. Certainly, we have CBOs in the United States that are some of the most popular PrEP providers, including the Magnet Clinic in San Francisco that now has 500 people on PrEP, and they started it, you know, just 9 months ago. And that's a completely nurse-run clinic that previously had only done HIV testing and sexually transmitted infection management. So, you know, contraceptive clinics, family planning clinics, general practices, and community-based organizations, you know, had a role in developing PrEP evidence. You know, one of our best clinics in IPREX was an activist organization that decided to do some testing and could provide the level of care required for PrEP. And they did it extremely effectively because they're so organically involved in their community. And so they were able to help people identify when they were in seasons of risk and what the nature of that risk was and when PrEP had an opportunity to help. So in terms of, you know, making this more efficient and allowing scale up, I think we're talking, you know, mass mobilization. We're talking about leveraging the skill and credibility of community-based organizations and task shifting. There's also efficiencies that are coming. We probably are still doing much more laboratory testing than we really need, and we're paying more for the drugs than they really cost to make. So there may be advantages on all of those fronts that we can identify and leverage in the next year.
Hi, related to delivery. Pardon me. Yes, we will be having greater guidance around approaches to decanting overburdened health systems through community ARV delivery approaches. We have had our task shifting recommendations, but we'll reiterate that these task shifting recommendations are also good for care for children and adolescents as well. We will be having a number of new policies that can help implement this by having fewer frequency, reducing the frequency of visits, task shifting, dispensing, and disbursement of ARVs, and task shifting some of the laboratory work. So in many ways, there will be approaches found in our service delivery guidelines that will allow for this greater decentralization and greater, use of different cadres of healthcare workers. But the problem we will have there is that as we put more and more burden onto community healthcare workers or community in general, we're going to have to ensure that that cadre of healthcare worker, that cadre of sort of, you know, trained but lay person also begins to find their place within the health system and that has some reimbursement, and we don't want them to be just now taking on a huge responsibility for an overburdened healthcare system without recompense. So there's more work to be done there, but at least the policies we'll be putting out will allow this to at least work in certain settings and at least set the tone for making these new sorts of service delivery models a reality.
Great. Thank you both so much. There are a number of additional questions that have come in. I realize we're toward the top of the hour. What I thought I might do, just to say, I know we have a lot of people on the line, but we've not been able to open up the line yet. So I wanted just to see if people did have burning questions. As I say, a bunch of them came in online, and we'll do our best to work with Meg and Bob and get some of these answers back out through the Advocates Network and post it on the web. But did want to just see if there were any questions. If you want to hit *7 to unmute your line, I would ask you to both introduce yourself and be brief, and also, in fact, to hit *6 when you're done to put yourself back on mute. So any questions from the line? Okay, people are very good at typing their questions. There was one question that came in, and actually I might ask it, but then in fact ask a colleague, Jim Pickett. I'll give you a quick heads up perhaps to chime in with an answer. Someone asked a really great question saying that they knew people who were accessing PrEP through, you know, non-traditional mechanisms, i.e. they weren't necessarily getting the straight prescription, and wondered how, what kind of impact that might have on data collection in terms of people accessing it and what their experiences are. And I know that Irma, working with AVAC and a number of other partners, are looking at actually conducting just that kind of survey. So I thought I'd maybe turn that question to you if you are still on the line. And star 7 to unmute, Jim.
I think I just unmuted.
You did.
Can you hear
me?
Go
ahead.
Yes. So, yeah, you said it. We are working with IRMA, AVAC, SCS, and UCLA on developing what we're calling a Prep in the Wild survey. It will be global. It'll be in multiple languages, Spanish, French, English, and German, at least. And we are going to be looking at those very questions, how people are getting PrEP outside of formal structures, what kind of programmatic elements they're including. So if someone is getting the drug on their own, are they also going for regular HIV testing? Are they going for STD screening? How are they managing that? We're planning to have at least two arms on the survey, so depending on whether you're a PrEP user or a PrEP prescriber. And we're also looking, we'll be asking, the questions will be relevant for people who are getting PrEP outside of formal structures in places where PrEP has been approved. And actually, it's only place, only U.S. has approved PrEP so far, but we'll probably get folks in the U.S. who are getting PrEP generically, doing it on their own, again, sort of outside of some formal structures. So stay tuned for that. We hope to launch this survey later in the year and then really hit hard in the beginning of 2016, and hopefully everyone on this call will help circulate it. So thanks for giving me a chance to talk about it, Mitchell.
Great. Well, thank you, and thanks for the question. Again, I know we're now past the top of the hour, but I wonder if I might just ask both Meg and Bob for any last thoughts in terms of the guidelines, and particularly I'd love to hear you both perhaps describe a bit of your hope. I'm sure it's just a relief to have them out, but I'd love to hear hopes and aspirations, knowing how hard you both worked on these, along with many other colleagues, but wonder if you just want to have some thoughts of what are your ideal next steps and priorities, not only for yourselves, but for advocates and others going forward.
Well,
thank you,
Bob. It's Bob. You know, this is just such exciting times, I think, for those of us who've worked in the AIDS epidemic, you know, really for such a long time, and we've had setbacks, and even when we've known ways, inroads that we could use to change the course of the epidemic, it didn't always happen, or it didn't happen on the scale that's needed. I think that this is a turning point where, you know, it's now clear based on evidence that both PrEP and widespread treatment have a pivotal role. I think having the normative guidance from WHO and having that guidance based on such incredibly rigorous systematic reviews is exciting for me. It really, you know, is an essential piece of the puzzle, but it leaves so much of the puzzle left undone. And what is exciting for me, though, is that the rest of the puzzle comes together through collaboration and community action and political mobilization. And so I think that we now have, you know, reason to get together, to work together to make this happen. And what's amazing about both this treatment recommendation as well as the PrEP recommendation is that they drive to the heart of HIV stigma. You know, and you know, every time I think about it, I think, you know, that the elephant in the room, the underlying problem with our approach to HIV, to ending HIV, is stigma. You know, we still have this notion that there's two groups of people. There's those living with HIV and those who aren't. And what's beautiful about treatment and PrEP is that it makes us all the same. We're all people, HIV impacted people, and it distributes responsibility for transmission across the board. It makes us all part of the solution. It makes it clear that we're all suffering from this epidemic, whether we got infected or not. And so the fact that both universal treatment and PrEP really undermines HIV stigma and potentially ends it, and that people are telling us that these things empower them, that's what's so exciting about this. I think we can finally heal from this epidemic, and we can finally take definitive action to just end this thing. Here's Meg.
I'm not sure I can follow that with anything more eloquent. I think from my perspective, it feels like it also, these recommendations now coalesce the global community. There's no differentiation in what one global unit or group is saying versus another. And so for that perspective, I think we're going to have a much more unified approach, much more support for moving forward. It's not going to be a debate about who should have this and who should have that. It will really be about, it's now the time to do our best to treat all, to put all on therapy, to look at or to make prevention options available, and then to really look at the lifetime of the person who is going to have to be either treated or preventing infection, and make sure that we have systems available. So I think it's just changing the dialogue now around doing it well, quality, and really. But I can't say anything more better than what Bob had to say, because I do believe the same thing, that it does equalize the playing field now. We just really have to do the work. I'm excited.
Well, I think, and I can tell, obviously, for many of the questions, both great thanks to both of you for a terrific presentation and clarity, but even more than that, a great deal of enthusiasm and excitement. And I think... And it came up a bunch, I think, in a number of the questions that you know, guidelines are not not necessarily the beginning, but they're not at all the end either. And we've had, over the last several years, a wonderful cascade of scientific evidence that is the beginning. And I really want to thank WHO for taking the next step and taking that evidence. And I think what's really nice is the table you showed, Meg, that's from the guidelines themselves. These are incredibly strong recommendations with very high quality evidence backing them up. And so it's really the 1-2 punch of evidence and guidelines, but of course then getting those guidelines adopted, getting them funded, getting the infrastructure developed to deliver, and recognizing that the guidelines really are an entry point to then make things happen. So, you know, I'm struck, and this came up in 2013 with the guideline update then, you know, of course, the day before the guidelines were released in 2013 and again last week, there was a treatment gap, and the guidelines didn't get more people on treatment. They actually increased the gap, and now we have a huge PrEP gap. So the advocacy agenda also grew exponentially from these guidelines, and that the advocacy to ensure that those gaps get filled, both with treatment and PrEP, but also with a robust research agenda for the additional options that we need biomedically, but also the research and the implementation to look at a whole range of different service delivery models. And then the one final thing I just wanted to add, and thanks to the guidelines, is something that you both talked about in both the treatment and the PrEP guidelines, and that was the importance of the offer, that these are done with a rights-based approach, and that while both very strong recommendations to treat and to provide PrEP as offers, and I think that is fundamental. So I think the WHO has really issued a groundbreaking set of guidelines and recommendations, and it's now our collective task to ensure that they do get adopted by countries, that they do get funded, and most of all, that they get implemented. So really to follow on what you both have said, the work really takes on new energy, new excitement, new challenges, but great opportunity. So thank you so much. And just to be clear, the recording of the call and the slides will be available. We'll also link to Meg's presentation from Vancouver to give you a sense of where the starting point is for success in adoption. And I am confident this will be just one of many, many calls over the weeks and months to come to help us all understand what more we need to do to really make this a reality. So thank you both very much, and thank you all for being on the call and for sticking through to the end.